Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're going to do a show today that I'll call evolutionary zoology. But it's not the usual scientific meaning of that term, which is the study of how animals have evolved. Instead, it's about the evolution of zoos themselves, how they've advanced from crude cages mounted on carts that were dragged from place to place to the sophisticated ecosystems that they've become today. My guest is Margot McKnight, the president and chief executive officer of the Palm Beach Zoo and Conservation Society, which I think is a fancy title for director of the Palm Beach Zoo, but with some other hats to go with it. And she's a great person to talk about this because she was formerly the senior vice president of conservation, science, and research at the Florida Aquarium in Tampa. And before that, she was executive director of the Wildlands Network Conservation Organization. And before that, she was executive director of the Brevard Zoo in Central Florida, a small zoo in which she developed a number of award-winning innovations that gained national recognition. Welcome, Margot.
Thank you, Court, and thanks for talking about this important topic. I love it.
Yeah, I do too, and I'm glad to have you on. Something tells me you like being around animals.
I do. Nature and animals, wild places, definitely.
We're going to talk about how zoos have evolved over the centuries, really, and then focus on kind of more recently. But let's start all the way back with like the Greeks and the Romans and I guess the Egyptians or whoever else had zoos or menageries, I think they were called back then. What were they like?
Certainly, I'm not a historian, but because I love this topic, I know a little bit about it. And certainly at the beginning, the Greeks and Romans, they really had a proclivity for having animals around them as pets, beasts of burden, of course, the horrible gladiator Colosseum entertainment piece. They loved animals, but it was more of a utilitarian entertainment type of relationship. It's just very, very different from the origin to now, how we love and care for our animals, you know, attach it to the importance of people, animals, and ecology and wild things.
Yeah, you mentioned the horrible gladiator thing, and apart from having humans fight big predatory animals, which is bad enough, I read that some of the emperors and so on would collect like 5,000 animals, you know, I'm talking tigers and lions and that kind of thing, and basically just kill thousands of them in a single day in a coliseum for the entertainment of themselves and their friends and an audience. Just incredible to think, you know, of that mindset compared to ours today. But then I think the rulers had their own private collections, more for their own amusement. So it was not a pretty scene for the animals. What about medieval times? I mean, moving forward from 2,000 years ago to only 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago or so, what were things like then?
Yeah, certainly. It definitely became a little more conscientious about how they cared for animals, but still nowhere near our standards now. And it's also reflected in how people took care of each other and what our expectations now of the rights of people and caring for people versus back then. So remember, we are animals, and the whole idea of caring for animals and caring for people is really closely linked. So the good news is we're much better today than we were, but I almost think the word a menagerie may have popped up during the medieval times. It seems like then it was more wealthy collections that started looking like our zoos, but it wasn't for public consumption. Certainly wasn't educational or science-based. It was more very wealthy people having these collections of animals that they were starting to figure out how to actually take care of them and feed them, where I think prior to that it was much more of a consumer of the wildlife. So the medieval time starts looking a little better than it certainly was in the Greek and Roman time.
Yeah, it may have been that the people who owned them weren't quite as lavishly rich or whatever, so the value of the animals themselves was a factor to them, so they tried to keep them alive and healthy better than killing them by the thousands just for the fun of it. So I mentioned the idea of, you know, cages where they would drag them around on carts, and you know, you have this kind of image of poking and prodding and the animals and starving them, but that would be more like a showman, you know, on a low level, a small scale, taking them from place to place for money as a job, as an income-producing thing for that person. Was that something that was going on in medieval times as well?
Yes, absolutely. There were no laws against this, and animals were just valued very differently. They were a commodity and, again, beasts of burden. They were really important. We didn't have automobiles, and So you have this grade of use of the animals, and that word is, I think, makes us cringe nowadays, but it absolutely was part of their life. Animals were, they were much closer to living with and around and fearful of wild animals.
Yeah.
So it was an absolutely different culture that people grew up with versus today we're so separated from them and wild things, which causes other problems. But yes, I agree with everything you said.
I was reading a little bit up on the show and preparing for it, you know, becoming a minor instant expert, as you can do now on Wikipedia and things. And so I ran into the term Enlightenment era in zoos, which I hadn't seen before. And I guess it referred to some of the big zoos in Europe, like the Jardin des Plantes in Paris in the early 1800s. And I remember actually reading a book that was years and years ago that was interesting, a very short book about a giraffe being transported all the way from Africa, you know, across the desert and then across part of the Mediterranean and over the mountains, the Pyrenees and everything, in this giant expedition, the whole saga of getting this giraffe up to the zoo in Paris, you know, and it finally arrived there safely. But that was, I guess, a different level of zoos, maybe the birth of the real modern zoo in a way, would you say, the Enlightenment era?
Yes, and I think the shift is also from private collections to public display. I think that the thought was we're bringing the world to you, and we're going through great expense and care to show you the world, because certainly back then people were not traveling like we do now. I think a big shift is away from private collections to public viewing, where that starts to make the connection between wild places, the world, and the people viewing them. You know, the educational piece also from an investigative sort of mode was starting to happen as well. Certainly science was blossoming, and having these animals up close to study was part of that Enlightenment era for sure.
Yeah, so clearly the education part, even just seeing the animals, I mean, they didn't have TV, obviously, or anything, or even publications were limited. So just seeing exotic animals from Africa, if you lived in the middle of Europe, was in itself educational. And so, of course, the animals were much better cared for, and the places they lived in were much more comfortable, I guess, and compatible with, you know, some sort of decent life for them. Yeah, I was thinking, I suppose circuses were partly a kind of zoo, since they had performing elephants and lions and tigers, and still do, and other animals like seals. You and I are both native Miamians, right? So I remember being in Miami when I was like six, and we went to a traveling circus, and it was all sand. Everything was sand, and the tents were all pitched in sand. And so people were getting stuck, and we got stuck in our car trying to get out of the parking lot after the circus ended. And they were using elephants to extricate people's cars from the sand. And so being like 6 years old, my brother's, you know, five and four, having an elephant come up and grab our front bumper with its trunk and walk backward and pull us out of the sand, to me, was like better than the whole circus. That was like, whoa, we were saved by an elephant. I mean, I still remember that, you know, a long, long time ago.
That is wild. That's a wild story.
And they would probably never do that today. But, you know, it didn't seem to be hurting the elephants, and it was certainly useful for clearing the crowd out. So anyway, so then we come to like the modern era, and that part of the thing that I was talking about with circuses is part of the modern era as well. But then there's the whole idea of zoos as roadside attractions, right? So, and that was a kind of a thing that ran from bad to worse, I suppose. And they were probably popular until maybe the late 70s or so. But in Florida, as you know, it would often be alligator farms, or in the Carolina Mountains, I'd see on vacation, there were displays of deer and foxes and dancing bears and that kind of thing. So, I mean, talk a little bit about, if you would, about the roadside attraction aspect of zoos.
Yeah, sure. Again, I feel like it's a indication of how we are evolving, not in the biological term of evolving, but how we're evolving in our feelings and understanding about animals and how important they are and how they live on this planet with us and have all of these sensitivities and needs that we're starting to understand better. And certainly when I was little, that wasn't part of a big worry with these roadside attractions. And having animals taken well care of, certainly some of them probably did, but the knowledge that we have now of what these species really need to thrive, not just exist, in human care is light years ahead of even when I was little. So having animals available for people to get close and inspired by, I think, is more important now than ever. But the care of those individuals needs to be at the absolute highest standard possible. we are just attracted to animals. We are animals, and we are just fascinated when we see these creatures that we may not see every day back then, and certainly now, even more removed from wildlife, we only see it on television or in print. And we know now, science tells us, that's not good enough to form these connections. The interest in these creatures has been clear, like you just walked us through time, has been clear. We love them in sometimes weird ways, these wild creatures, and now we're having deep understandings based in science on what they need, and how do we provide that and still make the connection between humans and animals, which back in the Greek and Roman era, the world was pretty healthy from an ecological standpoint. Mm-hmm. Now, not so much. So we need that connection more than ever. And the more urban we become, the more powerful these times where you share the same space and same air and hear and see and smell these creatures starts to make that connection.
You know, thinking about it, I mean, it's kind of like the phrase, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, right? So when the world was a dangerous place and nature was overwhelming humans and humans had to struggle to survive in nature, then animals were expendable. But now as they become rarer and their habitats become rarer, and as we are more educated and more conscious and more aware, we appreciate them more and more. So I'm kind of still walking through kind of the transition, you know, again, the ecology of zoos, right? So I'm still kind of tracking up to the modern and the kind of thing you were just describing. You know, again, as a Miamian, I remember you were talking about the our desire to be close to animals as opposed to just seeing them on the internet, on YouTube or whatever, or on TV. And I remember things like the parrot jungle and the Miami Serpentarium. Do you remember those?
Absolutely.
So they were like
Crandon Park Zoo.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
And the Seaquarium. So, you know, but especially in the parrot jungle, you know, you would get to have a parrot sitting on your shoulder and that kind of thing. And the Serpentarium, my gosh, I remember that vividly. There were pits full of writhing snakes. I remember seeing like 100 snakes mating, and they were just writhing together in this nightmarish way. And they also then, part of what, I guess his name was Bill Haas, lived a long, long time and became famous for doing this kind of thing. But he would milk poisonous snakes for their venom there as part of the entertainment. But they were also then selling it as anti-venom. And it was a useful function that he was doing there as part of the entertainment. But that was all fascinating. And those weren't too bad. But back when you were a kid, I was wondering, when you went to those places, Margo, did you think, gosh, someday I want to work in a place like this? I mean, did it inspire you?
It absolutely did. You know, having the luxury like you did of growing up in Miami, I had the Everglades, the Keys, you know, the beaches at my disposal. You know, when you're a kid and you get to spend time out in wild places, you may take it for granted, and I certainly did. But the other piece of the puzzle was when you're out in the Keys and the Everglades, you sometimes run into animals, and it's exciting. When you go to a zoo or an aquarium, you have these intimate experiences that are super rare in the wild, and I absolutely fell in love more by going to those places than, you know, was already in my DNA that caused me to go outside and look at frogs in my backyard. So absolutely, they were part of me growing up and falling in love with nature, for sure.
Fortunately for the world of animals, you got deep into it. Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Margo McKnight, who's the executive officer, I guess that means executive director of the Palm Beach Zoo. And she's been in a similar position in other zoos and in an aquarium and ran a wildlife network that was trying to do a contiguous long zone of wildlife-friendly land across three countries. So that was a big undertaking. You know, I was thinking, too, about the cage-free venues, which may be kind of the immediate precursor of the big, big zoos that exist around the country in places today. Places like Lion Country Safari, where the humans are in cars driving through the habitat rather than the animals being in a cage and the humans walking through looking at them. And so is that, you think it's valid? I mean, that's maybe a kind of a precursor of the big zoos that have a lot of land? And what do you think of that kind of venue?
Well, the space that the animals need to actually thrive under our care is going to be dictated by their behavior and their ecological needs. So a place like Lion Country Safari that has animals that need a lot of space and move around a lot, I think that's a really innovative way to actually see them. That works for that type of animal, I think, really well. Walking paths is another way, too, to have big open expanses so animals can actually have all of their behaviors that are so important and specific to that species. To me, having the space that the animal needs is the very most important thing you need. And then how do you create this interface between the guests and the animals? So some animals don't require that kind of space or very different space, like treetop living or in the water or having water and land. So creating the appropriate habitat that the animal's super comfortable in is the most important thing. So a drive-through aquarium would be hard. But I love the innovation of creating different ways for people. Certainly some places, Brevard Zoo is one, Disney's Animal Kingdom, where you can actually go on a treetop kind of ropes course and see animals. Wow. You know, what a memorable experience that is going to be. Some of the species that are a little more sedentary are easier to see up close, and koalas are a great example. They're not giant travelers, and they're super comfortable, you know, with their eucalyptus trees hanging out close to people. So it all depends, and that's what zoos are really great at now, is figuring out for the climate that the zoo is in and the species that they can create great ecosystems for, and great guest experience. That's definitely the way of the world now.
I know in the Brevard Zoo that some years back that you ran, and I mentioned that you started a number of innovative things. One was a kayak tour. I guess you could paddle a kayak through an ecosystem like you're describing and see the animals on the land while you're in the water, you know, in the kayak. And that was unusual, certainly for a small zoo it was. And so that kind of thing, I guess, you know, in a way is sort of like the Lion Country Safari, only you're in the water and they're on the land. And, you know, again, it's kind of simulating being in the wild. So you get that experience on top of just seeing the animals and experiencing the animals. So that's like a different dimension, I guess, huh?
Exactly. And the whole idea of getting people away from their television screens, computer screens, out of their cars, getting them immersed in natural areas is what we're trying to do. And kayaking through an African habitat is super memorable and fun. It's also physical. So the great thing about visiting a zoo or an aquarium is that you are actually getting a dose of nature. And now there's a lot of science that talks about how important that is for our not just emotional health, but emotional and physical health. The nature deficit disorder that was, I think, championed by Richard Louv's book. And then I don't know if you know about Wallace J. Nichols and the Blue Mind about water and how important that is for our health. So not only visiting a zoo or aquarium, we haven't even talked about the conservation work we all do, but not only does that connect you with nature and it's interesting and educational and helping save the planet's animals, but you actually get huge benefit from that. And the more we can make it these beautiful, immersive, natural areas, the more important it is, especially to urban areas. So you'll find most zoos and aquariums in urban centers, which is where they're going to have the biggest impact on the human population there. One, reminding that human population of the rest of the planet, but also a dose of healthy nature and really bonding with the people you go with and seeing other people and not through an interface of a screen. Certainly you have your iPhone and you're taking images and tweeting and talking and stuff, but hopefully it's about the place you're visiting sharing that with others.
Yeah, so I guess the more multidimensional it gets, and you use the term immersive, and I was thinking it at the second you said that, so that the more immersed you get in the experience in a full way, mind and body, then the better it is, the more memorable it is, and the better it is for you.
Exactly.
So you mentioned early on, as we've evolved toward taking better care of ourselves, we also think more about the needs of animals. And I wanted to talk for just a second about the animal rights movement, which kind of sprang up, or at least became a growing awareness anyway, in the 1970s. And then out of that grew PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And has that movement and the particular spearhead of it, which is embodied by PETA, has that had a direct effect on zoo practices in your career and your awareness?
The thing that I love about where we are right now is that people, period, are taking better care of animals, whether it's their dog or cat or wild creatures in zoos and aquariums. And the interest in ethical treatment and the HSUS, Humane Society of the United States, the fact that people, that pulls on their heartstrings and that they are caring about animals makes, to me, all of us kind of a winner. Certainly there are subgroups of those organizations are pushing for stricter or even more unusual requirements, and who knows where we're all going to go together as an animal movement, but animal welfare and animal wellness is at the very core of every zoo and aquarium. You can imagine each individual animal here has, you know, huge amounts of care that's given to it by a vet and a team and with the knowledge and science that's behind us now and all of the other zoos that we work with contributing. So the animal wellness and care has gone up by all standards tremendously. Mm. And it's because we care about it now. We didn't know what we didn't know, certainly in the Roman times, the medieval times, and even when I was born in the 60s, the knowledge that what it takes to take care of these animals, we know now so much more. So I don't know if it's probably sharpened some sticks, but it's all good, in my opinion, because we all care about animal wellness. Mostly the difference between what we do as a zoo or an aquarium and, for example, PETA, and they're starting to look at this too, is the focus on wild populations and conservation of these species in the wild, not just the care of them. That's where we have overlapping values. We both care about how animals are treated in managed care, whether you're a cat or you're a wolf. What zoos and aquariums, especially AZA, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, really is focused on is making sure that we're making a positive impact on wild populations. That's why I'm in zoos and aquariums, because that's what is impactful to every human on the planet, because it's one giant ecosystem. We know that now. So what we do here affects, you know, other countries, whether it's, you know, taking care of our waters and the Keys or our land. We're all connected.
Yeah, so the kind of greatly expanded care that you're talking about of the animals in a zoo obviously translates into higher costs. And you still have just the ticket price of admission and people coming in, and there's only a certain amount that a family can afford to pay, you know, so that must cause a train wreck sometimes, right? Because you've got added costs and really you can't rapidly ramp up income. I guess there must be grants and so on, but how do zoo directors like yourself deal with that?
Well, at the Palm Beach Zoo and Conservation Society, I'm in a great place because I have an amazing board. This zoo is going to have its 50th birthday next year, and the board and staff have been creating, especially for the last 10 or 15 years, an amazing place for people in our community, which extends all the way down to Miami, for what we talked about, an immersive experience where they can get out of the urban setting. Our board is amazingly generous, and they're constantly looking to connect this zoo with other people that can help, not just write checks, but to be there for us with expertise that other companies would have to pay for. Mm-hmm. So zoos and aquariums that are not-for-profits are amazingly creative about filling the gaps that you're talking about. Once you come into a zoo or an aquarium, also there's, for people who want really close-up experience, there's always another ticket you can buy, another, you know, bit of money you can spend that actually will help not just the welfare and care of the animals here, but of the conservation projects that we're doing out in the world. So it's a business, and it has an important mission. So when you spend money at a zoo or an aquarium that's a not-for-profit, you not only are having fun and you're learning and you're getting the dose of nature, but you're also actually contributing to conservation in the real world. And that is such an appealing thing for a lot of people. So being creative about money is certainly what we are all about. We do get grants. We do get individual gifts. Mm-hmm. And people love us, and they come and they... I think it's a great deal for hours of spending time in an urban setting, you know, having fun for the price of admission, which is, I think, still real reasonable across the board in our institutions.
Yeah, especially for families and kids, you know, that's so important because, you know, as we said earlier, I mean, they spend a lot of their lives on their cell phones or, you know, their iPhones and or sitting in front of a computer playing a video game or something like that. And it's just there's such right. a big world out there. And when you and I were kids, right. we would play until our tongues were dragging on the ground. And, you know, that's rare nowadays, you know, and the world is, in a way, a scarier, less safe place and is perceived as being even scarier than it may be. But it's still a factor. And it wasn't that way when you and I were kids. So, you know, I mentioned the big zoos, and I just want to kind of run through a couple of them because it surprised me how big some of them are. The Columbus Zoo in Ohio, near Columbus, Ohio, which was formerly run by your longtime friend Jack Hanna, who's kind of became famous during his career as the go-to guy to bring, you know, a monkey or whatever it might be, or, you know, or a leopard onto a late-night talk show like Johnny Carson or David Letterman or something. That zoo is on 582 acres. And then the Bronx Zoo, surprisingly enough, is on 265 acres. I don't know how they found a piece of ground that big in the Bronx. And the San Diego Zoo that we hear about a lot is only really 100 acres, but I think is widely thought to be maybe the best zoo in the world. So just kind of briefly, what characterizes these big zoos like that?
So all of those zoos you just mentioned are amazing places. Not only do they have great experiences for visitors, they are all deeply committed to conservation, which is, in my opinion, what makes a great zoo. Not just having a giant footprint or having, you know, headliner animals, but are you really tackling your mission, which all of our missions are attached to some kind of inspiring humans and helping the planet. I mean, any mission statement of a good zoo or aquarium is going to have that in it. And the zoos that you just mentioned are amazing. Jack Hanna is still attached to the Columbus Zoo, and they have some of the most innovative conservation programs I've ever heard of. The size doesn't matter to me of a zoo. What I just said, are you connected to your mission? Are you having a great guest experience? And most importantly, are you taking care of your animals and your care at the highest level possible? The good thing is the zoos you just mentioned are on the forefront of that often and have been. There's zoos that have been around for a long time, too, so they've earned their chops on all fronts.
Margot, we just have a minute or so left, so if I can ask you a question like this to answer briefly, which is probably not fair, but how do you see zoos continuing to evolve in the future?
I've talked about it a little bit already.
Yeah.
Is zoos are going to become more and more important the more urban we become, and they're going to be more and more important to bring the conservation issues that we need to tackle to people that are just entering our gates and falling in love with nature and leaving here transformed and living a little differently on the planet, whether it's changing their views on how they live day to day or who they vote for or what they read. We are going to continue to be pushing the conservation mission and stories and getting people to fall in love with nature, because we're desperately in need of that as we get less connected to it. So we need to unplug all our electronics and get some friends and go out and visit your local zoo or aquarium and get your dose of nature and help the planet.
spend a little time trying to merge with nature. So, Margot, we're going to have to leave it there. Let me just briefly give your website of your zoo, palmbeachzoo.org, I believe, right?
Yes.
Margot McKnight, director of Palm Beach Zoo. I want to thank you so much for being on with us. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Court. I love all your stories. Thanks for telling them.
Okay, good. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.